How you doing? Good. Well, what are some undeniable things about Easter? Let me give you a few, I reckon. It's undeniable that Aussies love a good long weekend, don't we? 4 days. And I reckon it's pretty certain that come Tuesday, it's just not long enough, right? So there'll be a few sick people come Tuesday morning. It's undeniable that we eat a lot of seafood at Easter. Just today, Good Friday, Aussies spent $25 million tucking into some seafood. Did you? I didn't. I heard prawns were at $100 a kilo. What's with that? So we went with the cheaper chicken, which was for lunch. But that's nothing. It is undeniable that Easter is very good news for the chocolate industry. This Easter, Aussies will spend $200 million on these tasty little bits of goodness. Did anyone miss out on a chockey? They came around. You can have my one because I'm such a good... Who missed out? Well, right up the back, let's do a risk assessment first. Woo! But we have themed our time together this Easter as Jesus undeniable. Because Jesus makes himself the key to having certainty about the big issues in life, both in this life now and the one to come beyond the grave. Of course, many people think that's silly. Many people do deny that. Stephen Hawking is one of them who describes a belief in the afterlife as a fairy story for people afraid of the dark. But some people go further than that and even deny that Jesus ever existed, right? So that what we're dealing with here tonight is just the stuff of myth and legend. It's not that hard to hear that comment actually in the lunchroom, Jesus didn't really exist, or on Twitter, where I jumped on today. It wasn't hard. There it is. Jesus Christ didn't exist until the Pope said he did. Now that's a very easy claim to throw out and make in the lunchroom or on Twitter. The problem is you'll have no expert agree with you. You'll have no ancient historian back up that claim. In fact, one Christian historian by the name of John Dixon was so sick of hearing this claim that he put out his kind of challenge on social media a few years ago where he said, "I will eat a page of my Bible if someone can find me just one professor of ancient history in any accredited university somewhere in the world who thinks Jesus never lived." That was 2014, and guess what? His Bible's still intact. He hasn't had a single nibble. Not because there's no one out there who doesn't want to see him eat his Bible, but because there's no expert in history that will side with that claim that Jesus was a figure of history. It's undeniable that this man that we gather to remember today was a figure of history. He walked this earth like you and I are. Not only can we be sure, though, that Jesus lived, we can be sure about the manner of his death. See, there's 4 independent gospels in the Bible. It's popular to think, the Bible just, someone sat down, wrote this myth and fairy tale. But actually in the New Testament, the first 4 books, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, are independent accounts. They're written independently of each other and they all speak about when the death of Jesus happened, where it happened and how it happened. Some people go, that's fine, it's all in the Bible. There's even evidence outside of the Bible. Let me just give you a taste of it. One of the men who speaks to it is a man called Tacitus. Tacitus writes in the 2nd century that Christus, which is the Greek form of Christ, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius. That's the emperor. The extreme penalty is crucifixion at the hands of Pontius Pilatus, Pilate, just as the New Testament speak to. There's another man, Josephus, who writes in the 1st century. Not a Christian, not sympathetic to the following of Jesus, who also writes that Pilate condemned Jesus to be crucified and to die. I could go on. But my point is this. Christianity doesn't appeal to wishful thinking or blind faith. Rather, its claims are grounded in historical events. And the most important of those events are a cross and an empty tomb. Those things that we remember this Easter. It is undeniable that Jesus lived. It is undeniable that he was crucified. The question then becomes, what is the meaning of his death? What is the meaning of it that for 2,000 years people have remembered it, particularly on this day? Well, I want to unpack that with you by looking at just three details in one of the eyewitness accounts in the New Testament. We just had it read to us by Sky from the account of Mark, and you'll actually find it's printed in your sheet so that you can see it. I'll take you through three details where we see a cry, a curtain, and a confession. You can understand the message of Good Friday of Christianity by considering a loud cry, a torn curtain, and a surprising confession. So let's do that, beginning with the cry. Some people's final words are actually a bit of a joke. Literally, there was an American who was executed by electric chair, and his name was James French. And he thought it would be pretty funny for his last words to be, "How's this for a headline? French fries." There you go, bit of a joke. Of course, other people's last words have been more moving and inspiring. You can't go past Can You Braveheart? William Wallace, freedom! And yet, the most disturbing last words that you will ever hear are in verse 34, where we read, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," Aramaic, the native tongue of Jesus, which means, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Now, verse 33 sets the scene for these final words, where we read that at noon, darkness came over the whole land until 3 in the afternoon. The light of the sun disappears when it should have been burning its brightest. And this is such a significant detail that it's recorded in Matthew's account, in Mark's account, as we're looking at here, in Luke's account, actually even outside of the Bible. We have the record of a first century historian named Thallus, not a Christian, not sympathetic to these things. He writes in 52 AD, just 20 years after these events. He writes a history of the Eastern Mediterranean, and he records this midday darkness. And he explains it as a natural phenomenon, a solar eclipse. So here you go, here's some more evidence outside of the Bible to corroborate the evidence, the claims in the Bible. But we now know, of course, that it wasn't a natural event. It wasn't a solar eclipse, because we know that they don't happen at a full moon, which is Passover, which is when Jesus was crucified. And even when solar eclipses occur, they last for a matter of minutes, not the 3 hours that we find recorded here. This is a supernatural darkness. God brought darkness into the physical realm to symbolize what was happening in the spiritual realm. See, in the Bible, darkness repeatedly symbolizes evil, and particularly God's judgment upon it. And therefore, this darkness reveals what's happening in Jesus' death. And it helps us understand the horror of his cry. Now, Jesus had many reasons to cry out in anguish. He'd just been abandoned by his closest friends and followers, his disciples, who had spent 3 years with him. They had pledged their allegiance to him, even saying, Jesus, we will go down with you to the death if that's what it takes. And yet the night before, when arrested, when things got going, when the going got tough, these disciples fled. They abandoned him. Jesus was initially arrested by the Jewish leaders. Jesus was a Jew. And the Jewish leaders then handed Jesus over to their enemies, the Romans. Here, a gross injustice is done. The Roman governor, Pontius Pilate, finds him innocent. And yet, he doesn't want the headache of a riot, and so he goes, fine, have him, crucify him. Jesus has been abandoned. He's been rejected, falsely condemned. He's then flogged and beaten. A crown of thorn was pressed down into his skull by mocking soldiers, where he was taken outside of the city and nailed to a cross, nails through his hands and his feet. Crucifixion itself was a slow and humiliating death, the most shameful of deaths. People walked by and hurled their insults at him. Jesus died the most physically excruciating and socially shameful deaths imaginable. Here is mankind throwing every evil they can on this man. And yet, Jesus doesn't cry out, my hands, my feet, it hurts too much. He doesn't cry out, my friends, my reputation, where have you gone? He cries, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus dies God forsaken. On the cross, Jesus was losing God. We hear the cry of a man in hell. If you were to come up to me after the service and say, I never want to see you again. I never want to hear from you again. Odds are, I'd be a bit disappointed. I'd be a bit hurt. But if I were to go home tonight and hear those words from my wife, I'd be devastated. I'd be crushed. Why? Because the longer the love, the deeper the love. And the deeper the love, the more painful is its loss. Some of us here tonight know too well the pain of losing a deep love. Well, take that and multiply it by a million and keep going. Because Jesus, the Son of God, had existed from eternity past with God, only ever knowing and enjoying perfect intimate relationship with God. In fact, elsewhere Jesus says, the Father and I are one. And yet on the cross, something in the very fabric of God is torn. And for the first time in eternity, Jesus was outside of God's blessing. And we hear the horror of that separation in his cry. Why? Why was he separated? Because Jesus took upon himself the darkness of human sin. And he was being destroyed by God's judgment upon it. Judgment Day was coming down upon Jesus, not just for the sin of one person or two people, but for the sin of the world. Jesus, who had committed no sin, but was willingly substituting himself with sinners, taking their punishment, your punishment, mine, upon himself. And it's this that helps us make sense of what would otherwise be a totally pointless death. See, I tell you the story of a man who was out at sea with a woman that he had pledged his love to. When all of a sudden he jumped in the water, went down and died. And you go, huh? That's weird. That seems a bit selfish, actually. Doesn't sound that loving. And then I tell you to imagine that classic scene of Titanic. The ship has gone down. Jack and Rose are in the freezing North Atlantic Ocean, where they climb up on the door, which was only big enough for one of them, apparently. And so Jack jumps into the freezing dark water, goes down to its depths, and is destroyed so that his beloved might live. That's a fictional ending from Hollywood that reflects what Jesus did in history. Jesus goes down into the darkness of human sin, forsaken by God, so that we don't have to be. Verse 37, with a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. There's the first thing that explains this event, a loud cry of God-forsakenness. Here's the second thing. It's a torn curtain. Verse 38, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Now, this is weird, right? We've just read of the most horrific death, and now Mark wants to tell us that some drapes are ruined. It's like, it just seems really weird. It seems really inappropriate and insensitive. What's going on here? Well, they're no ordinary drapes. This curtain is from the temple. Now, the temple was the place where people came to meet with God, to worship him, to bring their sacrifices before him, to pray before him. And God's immediate presence was symbolized in a small room at the center of the temple called the Most Holy of Holies. And in this room, it was separated from the rest of the temple by a big, tall, thick curtain, symbolizing that you couldn't just walk into the immediate presence of God. In fact, if you did, you would die. And in fact, there were many other divisions in the temple. If you were not a Jew, then you were restricted to the most outer of the courts. That's as close as you could get to God. If you were a Jewish woman, you could get one step further, but that was it. But even the Jewish men who could get another step further, none of them could just go into this place. There was another section for the priests, and it was only the chief priest, the high priest, who could come through this curtain into the Most Holy of Holies only on one day of the year, carrying a blood sacrifice on behalf of all the people, and even then he feared for his life. But as soon as Jesus dies, this curtain is torn from top to bottom. That detail is so that you would know who tore it. God did. What does it mean? It means the barrier between God and mankind has been torn down. You can now approach God and not die. In the sacrificial death of Jesus outside of the city, God is opening up direct access to himself. Think about how remarkable this is. See, you don't have direct access to a whole bunch of people who are far less important than God Almighty. Like, you can't just text Taylor Swift, hey Taylor, let's just hang out Friday night. What are you up to? You can't just have direct access to the US president, right? You know where he lives. It's a big house in Washington. It's white. But if you try and get through those front doors, it's not going to go well for you. And yet, by Jesus dying under the judgment of God, God is opening up access to himself. Get this, no matter who you are, no matter who you are, Jesus' death is opening access to the God of the universe, which is exactly the point of the next detail, the third point, a surprising confession. Verse 39, and when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus saw how he died, he said, surely this man was the Son of God. As we read through the account of Mark, we find that this is the first time in human history that Jesus has been declared to be the Son of God by man. Why is it surprising that it's on the lips of this Roman centurion? Well, think about it. He is not one of Jesus' followers, wanting him to be something that he's not. He's not even part of his family. He's not even a Jew. This man is definitely not soft and sentimental, not gullible. His job requirements included executing people in the most painful of ways. This is a hard man. This is a man who is not squirmish. He's seen many people die, but there is something radically different about the death of this man that leads him to conclude undeniably, this is the Son of God. Now, that term Son of God was used by a Roman, but for the emperor, for Caesar, who demonstrated his royalty by his military might. And it's true that the Romans did have other gods, but no other Roman god was crucified on a cross. This is the least likely of all men to declare Jesus, a man crucified in weakness, to be the Son of God. Why? What brings him to this conclusion? Verse 39, he saw how he died. He saw how he died. No doubt he had seen Jesus and observed him as he'd been arrested, as he'd been falsely charged and wrongly condemned. He'd seen the way that he had endured the beating and the mocking and the scorn and the persecution, and yet he didn't say a word. This man observed Jesus as though Jesus was aware that there was some great purpose in his pain. This centurion had read the sign that had been prepared and nailed above Jesus' head, which said, King of the Jews, which to the Jew means King of the Universe. He had witnessed the unexplainable three-hour darkness. He had heard Jesus' cry of being God forsaken, and the least likely of men came to the conclusion, this man is undeniably the Son of God. Well, if the Son of God was crucified, as this centurion concluded, let me finish with three undeniable things that follow. Firstly, it is undeniable that our world has deep problems, isn't it? It's undeniable. What we want to deny, though, is that we have any part to play in the world's brokenness. No. The problems out there, the problems that lot, or the problems that structure, or the lack of that, or the this, or the... I'm a good person. I'm trying hard to live a good life here. Surely God will be okay with me, yeah? But if all we needed to do to be okay with God was just to try our best, to be good, to turn over a new leaf, then what on earth is the innocent Son of God doing crucified on a cross? It makes no sense. Jesus' death means that we cannot deny that the evil in our world is present in our hearts. Our greed, our self-centeredness, our determination to put someone or something at the center of our lives other than God. Oh, you might not have thrown him out completely, but you've just put him over there, taken a bit of advice, come to him when you're in trouble. It's not just a little bit of offensive, that's evil. And God is a good, just God who must judge evil. He cannot, he will not let it go unnoticed, undealt with. Which means we desperately need his forgiveness. Every single person in this room. Of course, we can deny this, and many people do. But if this historical event is what the Bible is saying that it is, then to deny this truth now will leave you God-forsaken into eternity. The death of the Son of God means it's undeniable that we need God's forgiveness. Secondly, this is why it's Good Friday. This is why it's good news. This is why Christians celebrate. Because forgiveness is possible. What the cross makes undeniable is that God has loved you so much that he has absorbed the punishment that you deserve upon himself in Jesus, his Son. To forgive you, no matter who you are, no matter what you've done. So you might be here tonight, but maybe you were dragged along. You might consider yourself the least likely person to accept this Jesus as the Son of God. Are you too skeptical, too rational, too enlightened to go for this stuff? Has your family or religious background had nothing to do with Jesus? Do you see yourself as too hard a person to see any beauty shown for you in this brutal death? Or do you think that you've messed up your life so much that why would God want anything to do with me? Look at the centurion. Psychologically, emotionally, morally, ethnically, the least likely of all people to confess and behold Jesus as the Son of God. The least likely of all people. That's why it's the first one that we come across. God says, this Jesus, this my Son on the cross, is me saying, I love you. And as Bo put it beautifully in that story, come back, beloved. No matter who you are, what you've done, forgiveness is possible. It is free. By putting your trust in this Jesus, the Son of God, you come back into direct access with God Almighty. Take that tonight. Receive that. Or at least, if you're still skeptical, that's fine. Own where you're at. But be open-minded enough to follow the evidence. Hear at least that these claims are too big to just dismiss quickly. They're grounded in history. You can look into it. Come to this life series you heard about. Grab a book. In fact, we're giving away these. This is called The Case for Easter. We've got some other ones out there called The Case for the Resurrection. We'll give that to you. Look into the evidence to see if this man really is who he claims to be. And how about this? If there is a God, why don't you ask him that he would lead you into the truth? All right, God, if this is true, if this is your Son, show me. Thirdly, finally, the cross tells us that it is undeniable that we can trust God in the dark. See, for those of us, and there's many of us who have embrace Jesus as the Son of God, who are following him and who are celebrating every day, and particularly today. We can trust this God in the dark. See, suffering is often pointed to as evidence that God doesn't exist, or that he's not good, that he's not in control. But the Son of God being killed on a cross makes it undeniable that God knows suffering firsthand. Here is God, not above and beyond and cold to, but entering into the depths of suffering. And what appeared to be a hopeless end for Jesus, what looked like weakness and defeat, was God winning our salvation. Even in the greatest darkness, God was working out a good plan. Following Jesus doesn't remove our human experience of suffering. And even looking to the cross won't give you the reason for why you are suffering in a particular way. But looking at the cross will tell you what the reason is not. It's not because God doesn't love you. Because here is the Son of God, infinitely loved by God, suffering unimaginably. And yet by that suffering is achieving the most wonderful thing. For those of us who behold Jesus as the Son of God, we can trust God in our darkness because we're not in the dark about our God. We can trust Him in the dark because we're not in the dark about Him, about what He's like. He's good, undeniably good. He is merciful. He is trustworthy. He is in control and moving history to a fixed point. The cross says we can have undeniable confidence in the goodness of our God. And the resurrection, the fact that the tomb is empty that we'll celebrate, particularly on Sunday, makes it undeniable that darkness has been defeated, that death does not have the last word, and that there is light and life for those who would trust in Jesus, the Son of God. Do that. Keep doing that. This is undeniably good news.